Our guest on this edition of the podcast is a distinguished member of the legal profession, indeed a law professor. Those are usually the most articulate people in the country when it comes to analyzing not merely small issues of the law, but large issues of political process and of, one might say, political history. Frank H. Buckley is just such a person. He is these days a professor with the appropriate chair title, which I don't have in front of me, at one of the great institutions of this country, emerging in recent years as a very important educational institution, namely George Mason University. And he is, of course, a professor at the George Mason School of Law in Arlington, Virginia. Frank Buckley, thank you for joining us. And I want to plunge right into your new book. Let me give the title and then ask you to proceed. It is The Once and Future King, The Rise of Crown Government in America. It's interesting you take the Arthurian reference for your title, The Once and Future King, is originally King Arthur, or so it says on his supposed epitaph, which no one has ever actually found. But to work directly, may I ask you, please, to read the opening of your Chapter 5, The Rise of Crown Government. Take it away.
Milt, thank you so much for having me. And yes, the Latin tag was Hic Jacet Arthuris Rex Quondam Rex Futuris. Here lies Arthur, the once and future king.
Right.
Here's the beginning of Chapter 5. Over the last 250 years, America, Britain, and Canada have moved from monarchical to democratic government. In America, this resulted in a strengthened presidency and the separation of powers between the executive and legislative branches. In Britain and Canada, democracy extinguished what there was of a separation of powers and resulted in the unitary government of an all-powerful House of Commons. But if the forms of government diverged with the rise of democracy, they are all now beginning to converge around a powerful executive in the persons of the American president and the British and Canadian prime ministers. The modern state is guided less by legislation than in the past and more by what Hamilton in Federalist No. 70 described as executive energy. The government is led by a single person and not by party elders or cabinet. The change can be seen as a return to crown government, not a hereditary monarchy, but rather George Mason's elective monarch. Had this occurred in one country only, one would seek an explanation particular to that country. Since the change has risen in all three countries at about the same time, an explanation for the rise of crown government must be sought in economic changes and technological advances common to all three countries, and not in their different forms of government.
A large thesis, very succinctly summarized. Let us now plunge into the thought behind that. That thesis. Are you sure that individual initiative doesn't have anything to do with this? We think of some American presidents, say, who were all for expanding and grabbing more and more power and strengthening the presidency. I think the first, as certainly the second Roosevelt, are good exemplifications of that, as well as possibly the current president of the United States.
Absolutely right. The idea behind the Constitution was a wall should be erected which would prevent presidents from becoming what George Mason called an elective monarch. But over the years, chinks appeared in the wall, and they bore the fingerprints of people like Franklin Roosevelt and Nixon and Clinton and George W. Bush. But now what has happened, I think, is that Obama has pushed through the clinks and inserted his head on the other side. And that, I think, is dangerous.
Let's look at any of those administrations, all the way from Teddy Roosevelt to Barack Obama. What are some particular instances of the expansion and the seemingly permanent expansion of presidential power?
Well, a big one, and again common to all modern first world nations, is the rise of the regulatory state. The government, as we understand it, is not a thing of laws so much as regulations. So general laws are passed, And to a large extent, Congress will simply abdicate its roles and let the rules be written by the regulators. And that necessarily happens in all first world countries. Legislators can't simply legislate in sufficient specificity. That's a big one, and that coincides specifically with the 1930s and with the Roosevelt administration, and then just growing like Topsy ever since.
If you go back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, we have his alphabetitis or whatever, all those different agencies that were designated usually by three letters, all the way from WPA to SEC, et cetera, et cetera. Is that an instance of presidential initiative not requiring congressional approval, or did Congress go along for the ride?
Congress went along. Of course, in Roosevelt's time, in the and after the 1932 election, Congress was only too happy to give FDR a blank slate. They would pass general legislation, or Roosevelt would say, pass this, and they would do it promptly. That was the history of the first 100 days, and that gave us all those mischievous alphabet laws. But it's important to see the connection between the regulatory state and the executive. And the point is that somebody has to supervise or be responsible for the regulators, and that in all first world countries will be the executive.
If you look at the current administration, the Obama administration, there are some who are saying critically that he has, in essence, bypassed Congress. And has taken some initiatives which maybe ultimately would require impeachment review, for all I know. Some have indeed advocated that from the far right.
Is there
a difference between the Obama administration and earlier presidentially oriented administrations?
Well, there are a number of rather sharp differences. I'll give you a couple of for instances. I describe what I call the presidential spending power. I mean, we have this fine theory that money bills are to originate in the House of Representatives, and Congress is to agree to raising the debt ceiling. But most recently, the debt ceiling was simply raised, and I think that's a precedent that'll continue. On the TARP funds, the president was given roughly $1 trillion to spend however he will. Here's something that's interesting. The empowering legislation said the monies could be spent to bail out financial institutions. Now, you'll recall that some monies were spent on the auto industry, on GM and Chrysler, $80 million. These, we're not talking about GMAC, we're talking about the car manufacturers. These are not financial institutions. This was sharply, this was not authorized at all and sharply unconstitutional to the extent that monies are not to be spent unless authorized by Congress. And yet Congress blinked on this. It simply didn't want to take on the president. And that's the history of this all, of all of this.
Blinked indeed.
It's reminding me of
I guess it's Dean Rusk who says, we're standing eyeball to eyeball, and I think the other guy just blinked. That's a reference to foreign policy standoffs, but you're saying similar standoff has occurred within American government.
Well, that's right. And it's easy to understand how that happens because, on the one hand, you have the only person elected by the country as a whole. And on the other hand, you have a fractious bunch of congressmen who can't seem to get their act together and who are led seemingly inexpertly by a Speaker of the House from someplace in Ohio you never heard of. It's no contest. You see, here's what has happened in brief. The separation of powers doctrine, which was meant to prevent all of this, instead has been used as a device by ambitious presidents to expand their powers and to escape the purview of Congress. So it's like a boomerang that has come back and struck the person who launched it.
A very interesting moment in contemporary political life or in contemporary governance in this country was only a few months ago, I think, when the president complaining about Congress being so resistant to his will said, well, it doesn't worry me. I've got a pen and I've got a telephone. What did he mean by that?
Well, he can make laws to an important extent by diktat. One of his advisors said, stroke of the pen, law of the land, pretty neat. So he can do, he has what in the 18th century was called the royal prerogative, the ability of the crown to make laws untrammeled by the legislature. And the difference between us now and, say, parliamentary regimes is in a parliamentary regime, the prime minister is accountable to the House day by day. But you escape that accountability here. And, you know, again, it's a question of the separation of powers being used to do precisely that which it wasn't supposed to do, which is empower the president and raising the specter of again, the sainted George Mason's elected monarch.
Reading your, I think, superb and very important new book, The Once and Future King, The Rise of Crown Government in America, which I should add, by the way, is just recently published by Encounter Books. Reading it, and you do a good deal of contrasting or comparing American political history or governmental history with both British and Canadian. And it evoked for me a memory of my own adventure or misadventure. On the day before Margaret Thatcher fell and was, in essence, eliminated from the prime ministership of the United Kingdom, I was in the press gallery at the House of Commons. And it was a seething place. I was poking around as well and had an MP or two that I knew with whom I could sit around and listen to them talking to their colleagues and so on. And the sense I had is that this government is about to fall. It was very, very clear. And all sorts of people were vying to get in there and become the next prime minister. It was rather amazing to me, an American, and not particularly experienced in British politics. It was amazing to me how quickly a government, if the will was there in the House, could be unseated. That was in great contrast to, at that time, the only impeachment trial ever in the United States. Was it before or after Clinton's trial? I'm not sure now.
But it was before. It was 1990 before. And Clinton was 98.
There we are. So the only one that had ever happened was the impeachment trial of Andrew Johnson.
I'm going to put you on the spot.
Go ahead, sir.
The framers at the very last moment changed the rules with respect to impeachment. Up until September 4, the rule was a majority of the Senate could convict and remove a president. And right at the end, they slipped in a two-thirds supermajority. So here's my trivia question. What you're looking for is a case where the president is of one party and the House of Representatives is another party, held by another party, and two-thirds of a Senate is held by another party. And that's happened once in American history. And the answer to the question is, what year was that?
I won't try. It'll consume too much time. Tell me.
1868, you just told us. Uh-huh. Andrew Johnson, Democrat.
Yeah.
So the point is, it's you know, you talked about the fall of Margaret Thatcher. The point is, it can happen pretty quickly in other countries, and it doesn't happen so easily here. And again, it's an example of separation of powers, which is meant to prevent power from being concentrated, instead being applied by ambitious presidents to concentrate their power.
Well, I must instantly quote you to yourself. You say, listed as a suggestion for reform, Congress should impeach and remove presidents often, when their policies fail, when they are touched with scandal, or for no reason, just for the spirit of the thing. Is that so?
Wouldn't that be great? I'm an all-purpose congressionalist. Impeach them all, I say. I say that because whoever they are, the danger comes from them. Do you know what part of the problem is? Here's something that I don't think Americans recognize so easily as immigrants such as myself. That is the idea that you hear.
I'm going to stop you for a minute and make clear to our listeners that you're an immigrant from Canada.
Right.
Where to be sure they've got a parliamentary system.
Yeah. You know something? I'm due to become an American citizen this next month. And, you know, when you become a citizen, there's a panoply of rights and duties, but I think I'll be reminded more of the duties because the date of my swearing in is April 15. It's like, welcome to America, here's the bill.
That happens to be my birthday. And so on April 15th every year, I say to myself, death and taxes.
Inauspicious. Well, one thing you notice when you come here is the head of state is the head of government. And I'm, you know, it doesn't sound like a big deal. I think it's a huge deal. The president is revered in a way that politicians aren't in other countries. Think of the State of the Union address where Joe Wilson said, you lie.
Yeah.
On parliamentary language, but not such a big deal in a House of Commons. Or Obama essentially attacking the Supreme Court and Justice Alito mouthing the words not true and for that being excoriated for his disloyalty. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, I find that a little sick-making. You know, if there's some glorious achievement, it requires a presidential medal. If there's some tragedy, it requires a presidential speech for which Peggy Noonan will daub her eyes and write a piece in the Wall Street Journal. It really is sick-making to somebody from a parliamentary country.
If only
politicians should be figures of ridicule.
If only in the choice of his title, Arthur Schlesinger, of course, did anticipate this book of yours when he wrote The Imperial Presidency.
Right. Now, bear in mind, when somebody like Arthur Schlesinger Jr. writes a book called The Imperial Presidency, we're only talking about the scandal of Republican presidents. So
yeah.
Schlesinger was somebody who famously wanted to hobnob with the Kennedys and who was decidedly pro-presidential during the Carter administration. But in between, it was always the Republican tyrants.
Now, you do very strongly in this book. And in chapters that treat in full detail of the Constitutional Convention. I've learned a great deal about that interesting gathering, and it turns out to have been far more contentious, far more chancy, and some of the people far less redeemable or admirable than one has been led to imagine. But you do assert certainly strongly that the fathers and the brothers of the fathers, who were also members of the convention, really did not intend to set up a presidency of the sort that we've got. They really intended to make this, though it wasn't a parliamentary system, to make it just as flexible in controlling and limiting the power of the chief executive.
You're right. The framers in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 were the most splendid group of thinkers you could ever imagine, and their debates are the most exciting and wise set of disquisitions on the nature of government. But they're not read, and what's read in place is the Federalist Papers by the two people who are really very much in the outs, Hamilton and Madison. And the people who like a strong presidency tend to quote Hamilton, particularly Federalist 70, about energy in the executive. And I mean, to understand what happened in Philadelphia, you have to realize just how marginalized Hamilton was for those views. How he left Philadelphia. He thought himself a pariah in the middle of it. He left in the middle of it and just came back to sign the document at the end. And what people wanted from the Constitution was something so wholly different from what we have. There are so many things they didn't anticipate. They didn't anticipate the regulatory state. They didn't anticipate the role of the media in making rock stars of presidents. They didn't anticipate democracy, and they didn't anticipate an elected president, a popularly elected president. The question, shall we have the people elect the president, as happens now, was put to the delegates four times, and it failed each time. The question, should Congress appoint the presidency, was put to them six times, and it passed six times, once unanimously. And what they thought they ended up with was basically a congressionally elected president, because what the Constitution says is where a candidate for the presidency doesn't get a majority of the Electoral College votes, it's kicked over to the House voting by state. And they thought, well, that's going to happen all the time after Washington. I mean, there'll never be a national candidate. The last time that happened was 1824, and we've had national candidates since then. So they didn't know about parties. They didn't know about democracy. But what they thought was essentially, look, it's going to be the politicians in Congress picking the president. And that would have brought us much closer to, well, if not parliamentary, let's call it congressional government.
You treat of three particular nations in this book, the U.S. and Canada and the U.K., and you say that in all of them, the chief executive has gone towards acquisition of greater power and being essentially more isolated from or more impervious to parliamentary or legislative encroachments or legislative control. Is the same true as well of the other senior European democracies, of France, of Germany, of Italy, to the extent that Italy has a government for more than a week or two? Is this really the trend of modernity? And if so, why and how?
Well, there are two forms of government in amongst first world countries, or amongst the world in general, parliamentary and presidential. And comparing the United States to Britain or Canada, one wants to say, well, it's all worked out rather well, hasn't it? But when you look more broadly at countries that adopted either regime, you have to admit that the presidential system didn't travel very well. It didn't export very well. It went to a lot of countries, and it gave us presidents for life in many cases. Well, there are no prime ministers for life.
France has a six-year presidency, and you can't unseat him, short of, I suppose, some kind of arrangement for impeachment, if that were ever undertaken.
Yeah, France would be the other good example of a presidential regime that succeeded. It has a very different kind of constitution, with a weaker separation of powers, but France and the United States stand out as examples of countries with a presidential rule that works. But then you look at South America, and you have to admit that the admiration that South Americans had for the American regime after they achieved independence was misplaced. I did some number crunching on this one and came to the conclusion, as many people have, that presidential regimes aren't very good for liberty.
That's a very, very strong statement. Would you, as a new American citizen, advocate for that? In fact, you could now run for Congress and advocate it there if you choose that we rewrite the Constitution.
You know, law professors are really good at, what's called dreaming in technicolor, coming up with amendments to the Constitution. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we'll see constitutional conventions. I think that if there are changes that move us more towards congressional rule, it's going to require changes within the system. It'll require things like Congress getting its act together.
What would be a sign that Congress is beginning to get its act together?
Well, a start was made with what might be called the Tea Party Congress in 2010, saying we're not going to do earmarks. That's a pretty good start. Another example of that was the contract with America, with Newt Gingrich back in the 90s, which, together with Clinton's prudence, had a lot to do with the very successful economic decade of 20 years ago. I suggested other things. I suggested, for example, a national referendum run by Congress, which is something other countries do. I mean, if the problem is, you know, John Boehner from someplace in Ohio versus the president elected by the entire country, then the president has more legitimacy. So a way of Congress trying to get that kind of legitimacy would be see a national referendum on things like what do we do about Obamacare, what do we do about the debt problems of the country, the public debt problems. So you do that and you emerge from the referendum with a kind of gangbuster legitimacy that may carry through to enacted legislation.
That is a most interesting proposition, the most interesting suggestion. Has anyone put it forward? Has that been attempted at any
point? Well, yeah, that would be me a minute ago. it's something that other countries do. Scotland's going to have a referendum on
whether they're going to stay in the UK, yes.
That's right. I mean, in Canada, it's been done often. It was done on conscription in World War II. It was done on separatism in Quebec twice.
Yes, indeed.
It's curious that a parliamentary regime does this, and the Republic founded ostensibly on Lockean principles has problems with it.
How would you organize to do such a national referendum? Is it
well, the crucial
permissible
thing
and allowable within present constitutional limits or requirements?
Well, the crucial thing is it would have to come from Congress, and Congress would have to fund it, and of course, the president can veto it.
Uh-huh.
So you'd be looking for enabling legislation, which would be contentious, and I suspect in the present regime, it probably wouldn't go anywhere. And of course, you must expect in these cases that the press would unite behind the president and all of these things. So the press is wonderful in America because they're all monarchists. Right. They all revere the president, and they all want something like unlimited presidential powers, it seems. And I find that, again, as an immigrant, I will happily forswear allegiance to foreign potentates. Foreign princes, I'm not so sure about. They're trying to lowball me on that one, but we'll talk about that. I find it extraordinary that the press is so one-sided here. It just doesn't happen in other countries, other first world countries, to be sure.
Well, that is of great interest, and how do you explain it? What led to this presidential preferment by the American press? Would it be only for Democratic presidents, for that matter?
Well, there was certainly a lot of antipathy to George W. Bush, wasn't there?
There was.
I mean, we tend to forget the Bush hatred syndrome. A movie came out portraying the assassination of the president. But you know what that's like? I mean, getting back to the head of state, head of government business, there's a love affair with the presidency. And if your guy is not the president, if he's in the other party, you act like a spurned lover. You can't be neutral or tepid as you could in a parliamentary regime. You must either be completely wholeheartedly in favor, or you must reject him as one rejects a lover. I mean, just with anger, with hatred, with venom, and all of that. Whereas if your prime minister is simply thought to be a bumbling fool, who cares? Who takes that seriously?
This brings to mind one use of presidential power, and I think it now is also essentially possible for a premiership power, at least in the UK, that you don't need congressional approval to send the country to war. Surely George W. Bush, and indeed his father, both ignited or simulated wartime exploits by the U.S. military in the Middle East, twice around for George W., once around for his father.
You know, here's a case where you have to distinguish between, how shall I put it, between the Constitution as written and the constitutional conventions which govern us. The Constitution as written is generally taken to give the president the same prerogative powers employed by George III to continue a war that nobody else wanted in Britain in the 1780s. Contrast that to what happened in the debate over Syria in the House of Commons in Britain. Cameron walks in saying, right, let's do it, and here we go, let's vote on it, and he gets defeated in the House. Now, I'm here in Washington. I know what the feeling was just before that vote in the House of Commons. I mean, first of all the signals were that Obama was in favor of intervention. And moreover, the Republicans were very muted on the issue. I mean, they were going to go to law. And then you have the vote in the House of Commons, and all of a sudden, everybody changes their mind here. So, as a matter of prerogative, Cameron could have sent his troops into Syria in spite of that vote, and so could have Obama. But right after the vote was taken, the leader of the opposition asked the prime minister, well, will you respect the votes of the House? And he was told, well, yes, I'm not a fool. So the fact that you're accountable daily before the House of Commons really, really makes a difference. As to the war power here, The War Powers Resolution of 1974 is generally thought to be a dead letter. In other words, presidents can do what they want. And as to the resolutions to take the country to war in 1991 and 2002, number one, they don't seem to be necessary, but not only are they not necessary, they're not even sufficient to protect the president. I'm thinking of John Kerry, who was for it before he was against it. And the same is true of Hillary Clinton. The same is true of Joe Biden. They all voted for the resolution to send troops into Iraq in 2002. But then when they thought better of it, there was no accountability on their vote. So it's not only is it the case that the war, that you don't need the authorization, but it doesn't even help you.
If you go back to the beginnings of the current administration, there was the appointment of those many czars. Was that just journalistic neologism applied to describing something that's going on for a long time? Or was greater sort of extra legal or extra legislative authority now vested in yet other satraps responsible only to the president?
I don't think it's unconstitutional to have czars. I mean, the czars originated with Nixon or Ford. I can't remember. There are people like Jim Schlesinger and John M. Olin. William Simon, the energy czar. So, and you find, by the way, exactly the same thing in parliamentary regimes. So that's not a problem. There is a problem with recess appointments right now. But, you know, roughly the president can run the administration, including deep down into the regulatory bodies through his ability to appoint people. And that simply strengthens the executive.
One of my favorite quotations, I've used it before, possibly even in this podcast series, is from Casey Stengel. There's a day when he's managing the Mets and they've done particularly badly, lots of field errors. And as he's going off the field after that loss, he's heard to say, "Don't nobody here know how to play this game?"
Yeah.
Are we getting any better? Or is it the case that nobody here knows how to play this game? What's happening in terms of political evolution towards effective polity, towards general advance of the national interest?
I don't blame the politicians. You know, I'm originally a corporate lawyer, and there's something in corporate law called the business judgment rule, which is roughly means you don't tell your grandmother how to suck eggs or a businessman how to make money. Applied to politics, I guess there's something like a political judgment rule. So if people like Boehner, with whom I disagree, I guess, pretty often, decides to do one thing or not to do one thing, he's exercising a political judgment as to what will work with the voters. If, therefore, Congress seemingly has abdicated its role, it's because it thinks that taking on the president would be a matter of losing a great deal of votes. So if that's the case, the problem lies, dear Brutus, lies with the voters, not with John Boehner.
Mm-hmm.
And with respect to the voters, partly it's a question of, I think an amnesty for the people who are here without documentation would be a problem. But it's also a problem of the millennials, I think. There was a Quebec filmmaker, Denis Arcand, who has a movie about generational change and millennials and the idea, and he called it the barbarian invasions.
Uh-huh.
Every rising generation is a generation of barbarians. I was a barbarian. Everybody was a barbarian. But we're civilized by, you know, being taught better in school, by getting a job, by getting married. But something seems to be happening with this new generation, the millennials, who seemingly remain barbarians longer than most people. And partly it's the education. It's as they say, it's the culture.
Partly, by the way, they don't get married as early, or for that matter.
Yeah, they don't get married. They don't get married early. And if, you know, they take courses in university that don't train them for jobs, which is just okay because there ain't jobs to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is supposed to be the best of all possible forms of government. That is not merely American Republicanism, but the Democratic trend in which people are empowered. But increasingly, it does begin to look as if people aren't really all that much empowered at all, except at election time. And even there, one begins to become very aware of how adventitious or somehow uncertain and somehow uneasily manipulable elections are. Have we reached a phase where democracy doesn't really work? We do something else, we call it democracy, but it's not.
I don't think so. You know, there's this academic literature about how the American voters are not educated and they can't make good choices. And if I didn't know academics who make lousy choices, I might agree with that. But I think people roughly vote their interests. I talked about the millennials a moment ago. I don't want to say they're ignorant. I want to say rather that they know what they want, and I don't agree with them about what they want. But it takes very, very little information to vote your interests. In the 2012 election, which I think was epical, people voted their interests. They were offered a choice between a president who said, "I've got your back," and a candidate who said, "Let's increase the risk by moving to a more entrepreneurial society." And they voted for Obama. So I don't think they were, there's a lot of conservatives want to say, "Oh, they didn't know what was good for them." No, I'm not so sure. I think they voted their interests.
Well, what interests exactly were represented by the second run of Barack Obama?
Sorry, say that again.
What interests were, in fact, represented and served by Obama when he ran for the second time for the presidency?
Well, he ran on what I think is the crucial issue of our time, which is income inequality and more properly, income immobility. And what he said was, we have become an immobile society, and he's right. And he blamed greed for that. I don't think it's a question of greed. I think it's a question rather of a union of the upper class and the lowest class in society to exclude the middle class from rising. I think we have a system which serves wonderfully to ensure that if you're rich, your gardener's not going to move next door. And if we have an immigration system, we'll import the maids and gardeners who'll take care of us, but not people who'll take our jobs from us if we're part of the professional class. I see something like the Red Tory phenomenon of the 19th century with Disraeli, where the Tory upper class tried to unite with the lowest class against the mercantile interests, which were represented by the liberals.
So it is, it's a world of a Panglossian sort of reassurance. It is the best of all possible, if not ideal, worlds.
Well, you know the famous quote of Winston Churchill, "You can always rely on the Americans to do the right thing, but only after they've tried everything else."
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about that. There's a structural problem with American government, with the separation of powers. It's a problem of reversibility. What you tend to get here is a one-way ratchet in which bad ideas are made into law, and then you can never repeal them. Whereas in a parliamentary regime, you snap your fingers to repeal a law. There are no particular barriers.
Well, now, what if something like Obamacare had been instituted, say, in the UK, and then there was a groundswell of concern over how inefficient it was, how dysfunctional it was, how unworkable it was? Would the parliament reverse it and undo that law? Is it possible that our Congress, assuming that a Republican Congress is installed after the next election, could undertake to undo, not patch through patchwork, but totally reverse and repeal, so to speak, Obamacare? Or is that a fait accompli which can never be reversed?
Well, as you say, in England, it would have been rather easy. You would have had something like the fall of Margaret Thatcher in 1990. It was such a botched up job at launch that it's very possible the party would have said, let's run from this as quickly as we can, as Democratic candidates in 2014 are doing.
Yeah.
As for America, you'll recall that when at the last election, some Republicans ran on the issue of repealing Obamacare. Members of a Democratic caucus said, well, you can't repeal it. That's the law, right? As though there was something improper about somebody in Congress wanting to repeal a law. Whereas Obama has gone around repealing the law in bits and pieces all over the place by declining to enforce it.
And there are those even in his opposition, even in the Republican Party, who are saying those are essentially impeachable offenses.
Well, you know, impeachment is a political judgment. It's not so much a legal one. The presidents have to be accorded some measure of prerogative not to enforce laws when they don't make sense or when they're unconstitutional. But what Obama has done, which has not really been done before, is two things. One is he's used this power to decline to enforce laws that are clearly constitutional, and unlike the signing statements of George W. Bush, to do it to not propose legislation but pass legislation. So a good example would be the so-called DREAM Act. Congress mm-hmm. declined to liberalize immigration laws with respect to children born in other countries who wanted to regularize themselves here. Congress wouldn't do it, voted it down, in fact, and Obama came up with something very much like that as a matter of presidential diktat. Why do you need Congress, right? Well, here's the answer. Here's why you need Congress. If you didn't have Congress, how could you do a State of the Union?
Well, have you been describing essentially a system which is there and will not change? But everything changes sooner or later in history. Where are we going from here with regard to these particular issues, namely the distribution of power?
I tell you what I'd like to see. I'd like to see the development of a congressional party, a constitutional party that says, you know, this has gone too far. And to do that amongst Republicans, for example, what you have to do is leave by the wayside a certain kind of national greatness. Conservative. I'm thinking here of people like my friend John Yoo, who suffered from the brickbats of a whole bunch of people over his work in the Office of Legal Counsel and the torture memorandums, quote unquote. These are people, Nino Scalia, I think, would be another such person, for whom they always seem to imagine that they're defending a Republican president. And what they have to realize is that, firstly, you're not going to see a Republican president for a while in all likelihood. But secondly, there is simply a danger of an all-powerful president. And constitutional government requires the reassertion of congressional power. I would hope, therefore, to see a shakeout amongst people of both parties in which the powers of Congress are emphasized more and the danger of an all-powerful president is recognized.
Do you see anything brewing along those lines? Are there any particular outstanding public commentators,
the Tea Party would have been the best example of that, but the Contract of America as well. And, the problem is people come to Washington and they tend to go native. You know, partly there's this American vice, which is called niceness. I mean, on a list of your top 1,000 sins, niceness doesn't quite make it. But there's almost an unwillingness to take a firm stand if that would upset other people. I was teaching in France when the Borat movie came out, and my students said, "Is that what Americans are like?" And I said, "Yep, they're just nice." The movie was a satire on American niceness. It was almost like a big, fat, sloppy kiss at Americans because they came out looking great, right? But maybe I just see it because I'm in Washington, in the Washington area.
When you were teaching in Paris, that was at Sciences Po.
Yeah, at Sciences Po.
Um, but, the, you know, but, the, but, you know, politique. There were great political sophisticates there. What's their view of the difference between, say, France or other European countries and ours in regard to the matters that you and I have been discussing today?
Well, I have a good friend over there, and after a rather alcoholic dinner, he asked me the question that I think many Frenchmen want to ask. The question is, what do Americans really think of us? I'd had a lot of alcohol, and so I answered him truthfully. I said, they don't think of you at all. And he was crushed. I felt immediately very, very sorry for what I had said. I should have said is, well, they're absolutely obsessed with what the French are all about. But it's not like that, of course. So everybody else in the world is fascinated by America. You know, it's the star. Michael Pacht, a good friend of ours, made a movie, The Last 500 Meters, about the Battle of Fallujah. And the U.S. Marines actually got into the compound of one of the leaders of the resistance. And they found posters all over the place of Rambo and Schwarzenegger. So even these guys, you know, the people who most hated Americans, they were fascinated by American movie stars.
Yeah. As we come towards the close, time having elapsed, and I only have about 3 or 4 minutes left, I fear. Does party make a difference? That is, right now, I think maybe a Republican resurgence is in the cards. That's what pollsters are telling us, and the low performance ratings for the president would seem to suggest that as well. Will it make any difference with regard to the issues that we've been discussing? Or is the expansion of presidential power at the cost of the diminution of congressional assertiveness, is that the inevitable course of future history, more or less going forward for the next few decades?
I don't know. It sounds to me like you have 2014 called pretty well, but 2016, I don't know. I don't know if you had lunch recently, but I'll tell you about a bumper sticker I saw. It said, Hillary / Michelle 2016.
Oh, my God.
I think what you're asking is not so much about what will happen in 2016, but rather what will happen to the Republican Party and would it become a congressional party. And
yeah.
I don't know what the answer is, because the expansion of the presidential power has been pretty much a bipartisan affair. I mean, it's taken to lengths we've not seen before with Obama. But presidents, whomever they are, tend to worry about tend to want to expand presidential power. If you remember back in the 70s, Richard Nixon kept saying, it's not about me, it's about the presidency. So there is that, and there are, amongst conservatives, these national greatness types, represented by great people like Harvey Mansfield and the Weekly Standard. And then for them, it's we should like to have a very powerful president to do what we like.
It's been a delight talking with you, and it's been of great value to me to be reading, as I am still doing, in fact, the new book by Frank Buckley, The Once and Future King, The Rise of Crown Government in America. As we close, Frank, I want to read at least two comments by, they are blurbs, and they're obviously heartfelt blurbs. Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas School of Law says, the book is written with real brio and is a bracing read in every way. And Joseph Ellis of Mount Holyoke, well-known historian of essentially colonial and revolutionary America, says, this is a bold and willfully provocative critique of American presidential power. Buckley takes no prisoners, questioning all the conventional pieties and received wisdom along the way. If history truly is an argument without end, this is a new entry in the debate. So keep the argument going by all means.
Milt, thank you so much. Those were great blurbs. You should have seen what my mother said, though.
I look forward to seeing you soon. I think you're going to be in Chicago, and I plan to be at that occasion.
Thanks so much, Milt. Thanks so much for everything.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye for now.